My name is Kelton Cobb. I'm on the teaching staff this week. I've been here for 2 weeks. Last week, my wife, Heidi Gaiman, taught a class on St. Augustine's Confessions. Too bad you weren't here for that. That was the class of the summer. I can say that on behalf of my wife, who I know and respect. We both teach at Hartford Seminary in Hartford, Connecticut. I teach Christian theology and ethics. I've also written a book on theology of popular culture, so you're going to get little bits of that. Most of what I'm going to be doing this week, though, is new stuff, because I don't like to get bored with stuff I've already written. So I spent the whole day today preparing this. I've read a new book. I got all excited about it. Half of tonight's presentation is pulled out of that book. So I hope you'll enjoy that. But it may mean that sometimes I'm making certain assumptions about what you know about theology or about popular culture. So feel free to stop me and ask. There are no stupid questions. Now, I do teach Christian theology. From this week, you will not be able to detect that probably. But let me give you this cautionary note, self-cautionary note. I am a Christian. I love teaching Christian theology. Much of what we'll do this week has to do with both my fascination and horror at popular culture. Tonight, most of what you're going to see is my fascination with it. We're going to be considering two concepts from religious studies, manna and the sublime. And looking at various images, we're moving towards this evening looking at sacred space in particular and how we here in America, my take on popular culture is very American. To think about doing global popular culture is just too mind-boggling for me. We'll be looking at American sacred spaces. Now, the idea of looking at sacred spaces, we're in one. We're in an overtly, self-consciously sacred space. I mean, it's configured in particular ways. The geometry of this room, the objects in this room, the very heart of the room is a cross. This is an obvious sacred space. There are many sacred spaces in America, however, that are not so obvious. And I hope you don't leave this evening with the conclusion that other kinds of sacred spaces are more sacred than this one right here. This one right here sets the standard. And it really has set the standard for everybody in the West, every academic who has ever sat down and thought about what sacred space means. They all have a conventional sacred space, such as a Christian sanctuary in mind, when they start looking for it elsewhere. Now, you've probably heard this quote. It's attributed to at least four people. That the wilderness is my church. Now, you're not at Holden Village unless you're already sort of half convinced of that. And most of the people who say that, people like John Muir, don't go to church. Muir died long ago, but he was a Scottish Presbyterian. He stopped going to church. Yosemite became his church. And what people who say this have in mind is there are fewer layers of mediation between me and God when I'm out in the great outdoors. All the symbols in this room, this cross, this hearth, the paintings on the wall, that cross over there, I mean, this room is chock full of objects. These are all layers of mediation between us and God. Now, it's ironic, right? This is a Lutheran camp. Martin Luther was the one who was so unhappy with all the layers of mediation between God and the individual human person. But as human beings, we simply can't live without these layers of mediation. So, I mean, this room right here does represent a kind of a middle ground. It's not chock full. It's not saturated with religious symbols and layers of mediation. There are some here that direct our attention in the right way. Anyone who says, the wilderness is my church, is also making whopping assumptions. Attributing a certain symbolism to trees, to water, to the sky, to rock faces that they didn't come up with on their own with some kind of a pristine mind. Those connections to were given to them by the culture that surrounds us. I'm going to give you a tour tonight where I think you'll begin to see where those notions come from, that the wilderness is our church. But what I want to start with is this short exercise, which I've stolen brazenly from a website, www.manofthemovie.com, which actually is a movie, a wonderful movie. You should rent it sometime and watch it, about this concept of manna. I'm going to define manna after we go through this brief exercise. But I do want you to make, I do want to make it clear, this first part of the evening is not from me, it's from www.manofthemovie.com. Okay, this is an ordinary glass. This is also an ordinary glass. But this glass, this is the glass Princess Diana was last seen holding before her fatal accident. While this glass was only used at a table nearby. Which glass has more manna? They're physically identical, came from the same glass forgery, probably the same day, out of the same box, but these are very different glasses. Here is a cassette tape signed by Bob Dylan. Here is a document signed by Napoleon Bonaparte. Which has more manna? All right, let's have a showing of hands. A signed cassette tape signed by Bob Dylan. Okay. It's about a third of you. This document signed by Napoleon Bonaparte. Slightly more. This is a pretty divided group. It's interesting. We'll have fun this week.
I'm the other third.
Yeah.
Well, it's up to you. Manna depends upon beliefs and values. Now, one reason I told you this is not entirely my exercise is I don't entirely agree with that statement. It's not all up to us. Our culture gives us an awful lot. So I'd like to myself back away from the absoluteness of that statement. Nevertheless, it is important to keep in mind that much of what we perceive as power in the universe does depend upon our beliefs and values. This is an egg from a free-range chicken. This is an egg from an organic chicken. Which has more manna? All right, another showing of hands. A free-range chicken egg. Let's see your votes. Again, about a third, close to half maybe. What about an egg from an organic chicken? Slightly fewer. Now, make an argument. Those of you who have voted for a free-range chicken egg, why does it have more manna?
I know what free-range means.
Okay, good. And what does it mean?
It's a chicken at a good life.
Okay, we can assume that. Anything else? Anybody else who voted for the free-range chicken egg is bearing more manna than an organic chicken egg?
Got to eat out of the doors and eat what was there.
All right. It led a decent life.
I just know that the free-range chicken that we buy at QFC tastes better than the other.
It does.
And it costs more.
It tastes better and it costs more. Okay.
And I'm glad the chicken had a good life.
All right. Three good reasons. Those of you who voted for the organic chicken egg is having more manna. Why? Why does it have more manna?
Popular stamp of approval, the word organic.
So somebody, some source of authority has approved of it for a reason that you agree with.
Let's put the word organic on it. People buy into its
capital. Yeah, and actually that's a legal term. I mean, you can say natural about any kind of food, but to say organic, there are regulations that have to be met.
What would be the difference between the two?
Yeah. organic is a certain percentage of the food that the chicken eats. It's more than 50%. I think it's 75% must be certified organic. No poisons, no pesticides, etc. Yeah.
What is the definition of manna in this country?
Well, that's what we're working towards. Who wants to venture a guess? What is manna? So far, I mean, we got some material to work with now.
Cultural life. What gives life?
What gives life?
Power.
Power. Okay, good answers. What gives life and power?
Endowment.
Endowment in what sense?
As some reason to value it.
Okay, some reason to value it. Good. It has worth.
Sacred.
Sacred.
Okay. Honoring go into that?
What's that?
Honoring.
Honoring? Okay, there's a biblical word.
Daily bread.
Daily bread. Where does it come from in the Bible?
From heaven, while they were wandering in the wilderness.
Yeah, it's this bread that shows up in the morning. Supposedly it tastes good, although they get tired of it because it's the same thing every day. But you can't collect it. You can't hoard it or it rots. So this is a kind of a miracle that happens every day. A dispensation of a blessing.
A gift.
A gift.
It wasn't organic.
I don't know if divine is organic. I don't know. Manna depends upon belief. This is a rock brought back from the moon.
Well, I don't believe it.
In an organic egg crate.
This is a piece of ordinary concrete. Which has more manna? Okay. I'm not even going to ask you because you can sense this is a trick question. All right? This piece of ordinary concrete was from the house where your grandmother grew up after it was destroyed in the war. She kept this in her pocket during all the time she spent in refugee camp. For as long as you can remember, it sat on the mantle, and whenever she touched it, she would begin to cry. Now, okay, so whether or not something has manna has a lot to do with its origins and its background story. It's not simply the object. In fact, it has really very little to do with the physical object itself. Manna depends, once again, on what you know or believe about something. Okay. Does this place have manna? How many of you have been here? Where is this?
Vegas.
Oh, you're too smart for me. This is Las Vegas.
Las Vegas.
The Hotel Venetian in Las Vegas, Nevada. Now, if you had imagined that this was really Venice, how many of you would have said this place has manna? Okay, good. A quarter of you. The Hotel Venetian in Las Vegas, does it have manna?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, let's see some hands. Commit to it. Okay, an answer. Why? Justify that.
Because it's a beautiful place to go, and you experience things there that maybe sometimes is a life experience.
Yeah, you could just as if you go to the original Venice.
Yeah.
You can have transforming experiences. Hey, Las Vegas is one of the top 10 hottest tourist destinations in the world. A lot of people think it has manna. This hotel and every other casino in the city of Las Vegas has a whole lot of manna.
But it's just an illusion.
Depends upon beliefs and value. The Mirage. Simulation of a volcano. The Strip. I mean, this is just pulsating with manna, if you're so inclined. Okay, manna. Manna is technically a raw, undifferentiated power thought to reside in natural phenomena. Now, I say technically because this term goes back to the 19th century. And its origins come from missionaries here in North America and in the South Pacific. And what they observed, also known as, manna is actually the term that they believed they heard in the South Pacific, in Polynesia. Manna is also known as, here in North America, Orinda or Wakanda, or in more current parlance, Mojo.
How would you say that Vegas, those hotels in Vegas, represent natural phenomena?
Okay, this is the technical definition going back to the 19th century. It gets expanded, which is where we're headed now. And it's a fascinating evolution of the term. But let me just start here with what the missionary. When I say missionaries, I'm going back to the 16th century, starting in the 16th century. Jesuit missionaries coming to New England and to South America. What they observe is the indigenous peoples here in the Americas have this belief that certain objects have power. And it's an undifferentiated power. That's a really important term, undifferentiated power. We who have been formed by historical religions such as Christianity, Judaism, Islam, Buddhism, we connect sacred power with morality. And we put the sacred power upon whose side we believe we are on in the good column and in any other powers that are out there in the evil column. Undifferentiated power has nothing to do with morality. It has nothing to do with good and evil, good and bad, right and wrong. It's simply power. And you got to figure out what objects in your world have power so that you can approach them, appease them, placate them, sacrifice chickens to them, do whatever necessary to make them happy so that they will ensure the prosperity of your life. Make sure you have children, make sure your crops grow, make sure that there's not too much rain that will flood your village. Undifferentiated power. It's not the kind of power you establish a lasting relationship with. It's not the kind of power that we read about in the Hebrew Bible that we seek to covenant with. It's simply undifferentiated. It really doesn't give a damn about us. It's powerful. So we want to figure out what it wants, what it needs, satisfy it, and maybe it will return the favor. This is the root of the concept of manna, or Orinda, or Wakanda, or Mojo. Okay, now let's move to a slightly more refined development of this. Is this a familiar term, the sublime? Who can define sublime?
Sweet.
Sweet, in what sense? I hear all the little kids, my own two little boys have picked up this term this week, sweet. Anything they like is sweet. Thank you to your daughters for that.
It's actually sweet-o.
Sweet-o. The sublime. Sweet. Okay, we'll start there.
Ultimate.
Ultimate in what sense?
A pinnacle of...
Okay, pinnacle. Yeah, we're getting to some appropriate cluster of terms here.
An aesthetic instead of moral, I think of it as an aesthetic instead of a moral. So it's beautiful. When I think of something sublime, I think in terms of beauty.
Okay.
The definitive conclusion to the...
Definitive, you're talking about, you keep this ultimate cluster of terms. The sublime. Etymologically, sub, below, limen, the threshold. Break the word apart, below the threshold, beneath the limits, beneath the boundaries, beyond the boundaries. Technically, that's what it means. I know that's not very helpful, but I hope it will make a little more sense as we proceed. The sublime and the beautiful, these are two terms that get coupled up by two philosophers, two British philosophers, Edmund Burke in the late 18th century, late 17th century, wrote a book called The Sublime and the Beautiful. He was a British philosopher. Immanuel Kant, good Lutheran from Prussia, also wrote a book on
not
the sublime and the beautiful. Pardon me?
Not good Lutheran. I'm just kidding, Kelton.
Yeah, it depends on one's point of view, just like manna does. They both wrote about it, and they had this in common. The sublime has to do with those passions that arise within us when we are in the presence of two very different kinds of things. Vast natural landscapes, like the ocean, particularly in a storm. This valley, you look up from where we are at these granite peaks. I mean, you have the sense of the immensity of nature surrounding you, even passing by these deer on the way down here. I mean, when you're in the presence of a complex and immense natural landscape, there are certain passions that sometimes arise in you. Or when you're in the presence of spacious or magnificent buildings. Now here, of course, they're working with their own firsthand experience of being in a cathedral, either in Britain or in Germany, into one of these great Gothic spaces that have been created to conjure within us a sense of the sublime, sense of being in the presence of an undifferentiated or possibly a differentiated power, but a sacred power. But there are two things. The works of God can inspire within us these passions, which I'll tell you what they are in just a moment, or being entering a spacious or looking at it from the outside, a spacious or magnificent human construction. It is a feeling of delightful horror. There's a contrast there. Don't miss it. Delightful horror. Or a fear that is followed by a joy. But it's always first for them a fear or a horrification, a sense of terror that's then followed by a profound assurance, consolation, comfort.
Where would you put awe in that?
That's, yeah.
Awe goes right in there. Okay. And yeah. This guy, Rudolf Otto, another German Lutheran, 1917, wrote a book called The Idea of the Holy, where he picks up this tradition of thinking about the sublime. He gives it another name, the holy, which is what Kant and Burke were really talking about anyway. I mean, they were both Christians. They were talking about God who was reaching to us through the physical world, through the material world, and these experiences of the sublime. Otto's more explicit about it. Writes a book called The Idea of the Holy, introduces this Latin term, Mysterium et Tremendum, mystery and terror, or mystery and tremendousness. And Otto's idea is that it's not so much that a fear is followed by a joy as it is that when we're in the presence of something that we are convinced is holy, is genuinely sacred, God, we will simultaneously have feelings of attraction and repulsion. Mystery attracts, terror repulses. So if you're ever experiencing a moment where there's this rise of passions within you, simultaneously terrifying and alluring, that's a good indication that you're in the presence of what is for you down deep, the holy. Okay, now let's work with some concrete images. Has anybody ever been to this place? Do you know what it is?
It's the National Bridge. It's got like a four-way highway on it. It's in West Virginia, I think.
Yeah, it's in Virginia. It's the National Bridge. This was the first tourist attraction in the United States. The first institutionalized tourist attraction in the United States. It was not carved by human beings. This is a natural formation in Virginia. Thomas Jefferson wrote extensively about it in his journal. He was certainly impressed by it. The first people who went there, I think I may even be able to read some passages or a passage about it to give you an idea. Going back into the 18th century. Okay, 1819. This is a journalist. A journalist writing in 1819. He's been to the Natural Bridge. He writes that he, quote, was so struck with the grandeur and majesty of the scene as to become for several minutes terrified and nailed to the spot. Mm-hmm. Terrified and nailed to the spot. This is in 1819. long before Rudolf Otto wrote The Idea of the Holy. I found myself incapable of moving forward. After recovering in some degree from this, I may truly say, agonizing mental state of excitement, the author approached the arch with trembling and trepidation. It was about this time, beginning in the 1820s, that an industry developed around this. Now, if any of you have ever been to, now you're Lutheran, so I'm not Lutheran, so I can make all these Lutheran jokes if I want to. But if any of you have ever been to a Catholic shrine, particularly one of the Marian sites of Virgin Mary in Ireland at Knock or in Lourdes, or the Częstochowa in Poland, we have all kinds of, if you've ever been to the University of Notre Dame, they've got a reproduction of the cave at Lourdes where these peasants saw the Virgin Mary. I mean, Catholics do this all the time. They sense that there's a sacred spot, sacred precincts somewhere. Usually there's a well. That's interesting. There's a well that water's bubbling up out of. This, of course, becomes holy water. But, or Rome, that's the great example. I mean, there are industries that form themselves around these sites. Now, to a Protestant going to this, we can, you know, call it crass or have a feeling that we're not in the presence of the holy, but in the presence of some kind of commercialization of the divine. But we Protestants have our own way of doing this. Our camps, Holden Village, are one of those. Where we come and they'll all inevitably have a bookstore with souvenirs and things that you can buy. These are things we take back to remember the holy experiences we had the week we were here. Well, that's what these great religious sites and shrines of all the world religions have always been about. What's interesting is in America, this starts happening in a way that it hadn't happened in Europe, simply around natural objects. The same kind of industry starts to emerge. Hostels, inns, restaurants, souvenirs, small factories to produce these souvenirs, tours, all kinds of angles to get at it. Now, the natural bridge is a relatively non-complex site. But what follows a natural bridge in American tourism history is the granddaddy of them all, Niagara Falls. Okay, now, it's safe to say, because I've been there, that this has been photoshopped. Because you don't see in the background any of the developments, any of the urban developments on either side of the river. But whoever photoshopped it had a sense for the sublime. And they are exaggerating its features, as has been done for 200 years. Here's a much older image. Painting by Frederick Church from 1867, interesting year, 2 years after the end of the Civil War. Painting of Niagara Falls, rainbow at the bottom. Now Church is one of these great painters, naturalist painters from the 19th century, who does throw in all kinds of biblical imagery in ways that are not advertising themselves. Trust me, that rainbow has a biblical connotation, as does the water. But Church is educated in this literature of the sublime. He's actually read Kant and Burke. And he's a painter. And he is out there painting all kinds of paintings of the sublime, starting with Niagara Falls here, another famous painting from the same era. Albert Bierstadt, Niagara Falls, another rainbow. 2 years later, how many of you have heard of Bierstadt before? He's got paintings in just about every art museum across the country. Yeah, I expect you have. I mean, he's a tremendous painter. And he took a tour out west. I mean, this is in upstate New York. He's from somewhere in New England. I can't remember where. Maybe along the Hudson River. German immigrant. But he comes across the country to the west coast, I think in the 1880s, on the railroad. And he paints Yellowstone, he paints the Grand Canyon, he paints Yosemite, he paints the Rocky Mountains. Tremendous paintings. And these are, you know, these paintings are about that size. I mean, I like it. I mean, I get sucked into it. Okay, I'll come back to Bierstadt in just a minute. I think when we look at the Grand Canyon. Now, look at the date here. 18, there's this bridge that's built across. Now, we're the reason you don't see Niagara Falls here is you're standing sort of, or Niagara Falls is behind the camera. So you're looking downriver. But this is, I think, the first suspension bridge ever built. The second suspension bridge ever built. The first one was built in Pittsburgh. This was the second one ever built here in America, anywhere in the world, but it was built here in America. It became, because people got bored, believe it or not, or they stopped having these powerful, sublime experiences of the sublime when they went to Niagara Falls. So the suspension bridge started to receive their redirected desire to have an experience of the sublime. And you can see this in both photographic art and in paintings, that this bridge starts to get more attention than the falls themselves. Or at least gets co-billing. Such as here, this Courier and Ives postcard from about the same time. This is a double-deck bridge, train bridge above, wagons and pedestrians below. The falls are in the distant background here. But here, the bridge dominates the falls, which is one of the shifts that begins to happen in the middle of the 19th century in the American understanding of the sublime. We start paying more attention to man-made objects, the second category that Kant had identified. No longer the works of God, but the works of man, that conjure in us the magnificence, the immensity, the incredible achievement that a structure like this was. It's hard for us to comprehend because we're so used to 5 or 10 mile long tunnels or bridges, or I mean, but at the time to cross a river of this size was an unprecedented achievement. Here you get kind of both going on. You get both the railroad and Niagara Falls in the background. Now this, of course, is done by the Michigan Central Railroad. This is tourist literature. Let me read a passage about Niagara. Go back to the early 19th century now, before the suspension bridge and the railroad reached there. This is a man from Philadelphia, just a guy, a tourist from Philadelphia, gets back and writes this. This is early 19th century. By the way, this book that I'm so intrigued by right now is by David Nye, N-Y-E. It's called The American Technological Sublime. So this guy, this tourist from Philadelphia, early 19th century, around the 1820s, writes, I leave this spot, Niagara Falls, I trust a better man. I hope we all leave Holden Village better men and women. I leave this spot, I trust a better man. What mind is not enlarged, what soul is not filled with ennobling emotions by the contemplation of such wonders? Another tourist from Michigan wrote this, same period of time. When I saw Niagara, I stood dumb. I was lost in wonder, love, and praise. Can it be that the mighty God who has cleft these rocks with a stroke of his power, who has bid these waters roll on to the end of time, foaming, dashing, thundering in their course, can it be that this mighty being has said to insignificant mortals, I will be thy God and thou shalt be my people? Roll on, thou great Niagara, roll on, and by the ceaseless roaring, lead the minds of mortals from nature's contemplation up to nature's God. The inspiration of a powerful natural phenomenon to direct our attention through it, as if it is a window, not a crystal clear window, but a murky window, a foggy window, on the other side of which we sense is the divine. Okay, where is this?
Yosemite.
Yosemite Valley, right. Bierstadt. 1865, the end of the Civil War. So he was out there earlier than I recall. So he's out there. He paints this painting. This is my favorite by him. I mean, you really have the sense here of, you know what the Shekinah is from the Hebrew Bible, the glory of God, that it's deep, deep in the background of this valley, sort of leading us forward down through these pastures to ultimately to reach an experience of mystical union with God, the beatific vision, being face to face with God, the light of God's own countenance at the very end of our lives. This is the course of a life. This is how skilled Bierstadt is. Now that's ironic. I'll tell you why in just a second. Here's another, oh, we'll come back to this. Anybody know, recognize this? Whose is it? Who's the painter? I heard it. Thomas Kincaid, right. Thomas Kincaid fancies himself as the 20th and 21st century's Albert Bierstadt. Beginning of a perfect day. This again looks a lot like where we are right now, if we could see outside of these walls. Thomas Kincaid, about 52 years old right now. As of 2 years ago, he was described as the most highly compensated, in other words, most highly compensated painter in the history of the world. In other words, most painters don't, their paintings don't gain value until they're dead, but he's only in his 50s, in his early 40s when he became a kind of a painting star. This guy makes like $50 million a year from his paintings. And he's not even selling his paintings, he's selling reproductions of his paintings, which get then dollops of paint by either him or armies of starving artists who make these additions. And his paintings go from somewhere around $400 to $30,000. He's painting the sublime. He knows it. We have a taste for it. We have an appetite for it. Looking down the Valley of the Yosemite, another Bierstadt painting came out a year later, Yosemite Valley. Now, what's interesting about Bierstadt was he was actually on commission from the Northern Pacific Railroad. They wanted to drum up interest out east for these magnificent, sublime sites in the west. I mean, as wonderful as this art is, and I love to see it, I look for Bierstadt paintings so I can get lost in them when I go to a new art museum. But these were produced as tourist brochures. Before an era of full-color photography. Okay. Where's this? Good. Grand Canyon. Thomas Moran. It's 1873. The chasm of the Colorado River. Grand Canyon is another one of these early sites that gets identified as a tourist destination, but a tourist destination because it is a place where you can practically be guaranteed of having an experience that's sublime. And both the paintings of it, the graphic depictions of it, the literature on it, stress this fact. See, I think I've got a passage on. I don't, but I got a series of images that are kind of interesting on this. So here's the Grand Canyon in kind of its mid-19th century pristine, sublime purity. I mean, he's really pouring the sublime on. It's not only the chasm itself, this deep hole in the ground, the mysterious dark hole, almost bottomless or infinite hole, but there's also coming up down from above this turbulent storm. We're getting pressed into an experience of the sublime both from below and above here. And it's not a complaint from me. Okay. Photograph taken within the last year of the Grand Canyon. So Moran is exaggerating some features, but it is. I mean, this is an incredible place. A magnificent natural phenomena. You see off to the left, this is brand new. It was opened a year ago. The Grand Canyon Skywalk, which extends out over the canyon, over a vertical wall of the canyon, put up by this very small Indian tribe, the Hualapai, 2,000 Hualapai Indians in the world today. Like they have certain privileges to put up casinos around the country, they have certain privileges to build concessions at Grand Canyon that nobody else has. And this is just the beginning. This is a glass walkway that you can look straight down. You can go out and out, and they assure you that they could stack something like 167 fully loaded 747 aircraft on top of this thing, and it wouldn't collapse. You have to put on special soft slippers to go out there so you won't scratch the glass, because you are walking on glass. See, this is we erect tourist sites to get ourselves into contact with these experiences of the sublime. Receiving a blessing. Now here's one. This has nothing to do with the skywalk, but this is the Grand Canyon. This is an ad. And by the way, tomorrow we're going to look at a lot of ads if you come back. Commercials. It will be actually moving pictures tomorrow.
Yes, sir.
But this is an ad for Nissan. SUV. You see it there? And it's a quote from Charles Darwin. Nature selects those who best adapt to their surroundings. Now, this is, of course, before the current gas crisis. Mm-hmm. I don't think the SUVs are adapting that well to their surroundings right now. But here, I mean, some correlation is being drawn here, not only between the toughness of this vehicle, but also between this vehicle and an experience of the sublime. Buy this vehicle, you'll get yourself into sublime places. Okay, bridges. You see this evolution in the 19th century here in America. It doesn't happen quite the same way in Europe, but you see this evolution. The experience of the sublime, as we're discovering all of our great treasures in this country, natural treasures. Our predecessors 150 years ago were just like us. They were easily jaded. They got used to what, for their parents, had been experiences of the sublime. And we all, you know, I read you a few passages of these tourists who went to Niagara Falls. I could also read you passages about how some of these people went, and it was nothing like it had been cracked up to be in the tourist literature. And so they get there and they're disappointed. They've been so over-prepared to have an experience of the sublime that when they get there, it's such a disappointment. And then they write about what a disappointment it was. And attention starts to shift away from the natural phenomena of this country towards these technological achievements, which really did surpass the rest of the world. American bridge building in the 19th century so exceeded what was going on in Europe or anywhere else in the world. I mean, we really were history's first great bridge builders. This is the Eads Bridge in St. Louis, Missouri, still standing. It was completed in 1867, this great achievement. I mean, there was this rush to finish it right after the Civil War. I think Eads was, in fact, had been a general in the war and had been an engineer before that. So he goes to St. Louis and he builds this bridge. This was quite an achievement. And he had to invent all kinds of technologies to put these pylons deep into the Mississippi River. That's a wide river. And it could only be crossed with ferries before that. But you've got a railroad now that wants to cross the country. Well, what do you do? Do you take the train up to the Mississippi River, then you unload all the cargo onto a ferry, take it across, and load it onto another train? I mean, they didn't want to do that. So that provided the incentive to start exploring these bridges, different technologies for bridges to cross really incredible spans of water. Now, these were not only technological achievements. Let me read you a passage about, this is from Walt Whitman, the transcendentalist New England poet, who writes this. He actually went to St. Louis and saw this bridge. This is what he writes about it. "I was haunted by the river every night lately. where I could get a look at the bridge by moonlight. It is indeed a structure of perfection and beauty unsurpassable, and I never tire of it. I am out pretty late. It is so fascinating and dreamy. This is one of our great nature poets. The Brooklyn Bridge, completed in 1883, used similar technology to sink its pylons. I don't want to get into the technology of this. If you're interested, we can talk about it later. It's just incredible what they came up with. And a lot of workers lost their lives building these two bridges because they were inventing the technology necessary to do so. It was a lot of trial and error. The Brooklyn Bridge. Mayor Seth Lowe of Brooklyn, upon the opening of the bridge, put it this way, quote, "The impression upon the visitor is one of astonishment that grows with every visit to the bridge. No one who has been upon it can ever forget it. This great structure cannot be confined to the limits of local pride. The glory of it belongs to the race. Not one shall see it and not feel prouder to be a man. The bridge is a trophy of triumph over an obstacle of nature." Now it's the sublime. People are having an experience of the sublime with man-made objects that are conquering nature. "It broke down barriers and thus stood for the solidarity of the human race." This is from Nye. One more quote. This is from a man named Joseph Stella, who was a painter. This is right after the First World War. He writes this about the Brooklyn Bridge. "Many nights I stood on the bridge. I felt deeply moved, as if on the threshold of a new religion or in the presence of a new divinity." Brooklyn Bridge, more modern. I've walked across this bridge. I've had an experience of the sublime on this bridge. It's not only the structure of the bridge itself, but the city that surrounds it and the vistas of the city that you get. And you have a sense, just in the, like with the classic definition of the sublime, you have a sense of your own smallness in the presence of some great immensity, which is at first horrifying, but in the end it's comforting because you're part of this great human mass. Okay, here's one that's maybe easier to relate to out here in the West. The Golden Gate Bridge, which was completed maybe 75 years ago, about then. Here you get a sense of the mystery. Golden Gate Bridge, completed in 1937. If you really want to see both natural phenomena and human constructions presented in their most sublime light, get a hold of postcards. Because people who make postcards, whether they know it consciously or unconsciously, they know the sublime and they can create it through their images. Here's a great one. This is called the Corliss Engine. Corliss, after George Corliss, another image of it. Now, this made it, I think, its first great public appearance at the 1876 Philadelphia World Exposition, World's Fair in Philadelphia, 1876, the centennial of the United States. George Corliss assembled this engine. It was actually two engines to power this huge flywheel. Give you a sense of the scale. Here you got human beings. This was in the machine exhibit at the Philadelphia Centennial Exposition in 1876, which was the big draw. And I mean, technology has been the big draw of most World's Fairs from the very beginning of the World's Fair movement. People describe having had an experience of the sublime in the presence of this steam engine, which was powering every single machine under this roof in this great glass arena. Cotton gins, mills, every machine that they had in 1876 was being powered from this central engine. which was not a loud diesel-type engine. This was a steam engine. It was very quiet. It just made these kinds of puffs. People were really overwhelmed by it. Let me read a passage about that. A guidebook, this is Nye writing, the author of the book, a guidebook ordered readers to begin their visit to the Centennial Exposition at Machinery Hall. Quote from the guidebook now. The first thing to do is to see the tremendous iron heart whose energies are pulsating around us. Walt Whitman also goes to the Philadelphia Exposition, and he, by then he's a very old man, and he asks to be carried in his chair to observe this Corliss engine, and he sits there for half an hour in absolute silence. I mean, it's again hard for us to relate to, but our ancestors 130 years ago, I'm going to reinforce this with the next several slides, the idea of a tremendous iron heart whose energies are pulsating around us in an era that is just for the first time discovering artificial forms of power. I mean, you can sort of see and appreciate why it was that their attention is gravitating away from natural phenomena and towards humanly constructed technology. I mean, so much that we take for granted, you know, was brand new for them. Does anybody, looking at this image, does anybody have an experience of the sublime? Nobody. Okay. This is in New York. This was in the process of being torn down. This was Thomas Edison's first power plant in Midtown Manhattan, right adjacent to the United Nations building. But in the early 20th century, have any of you ever seen stereoscopic slides? Two images side by side, you look at them through lenses, and you get a three-dimensional effect. This was made into stereoscopic slides. It was so striking, so impressive to people in the early 20th century. Maybe you could see it a little bit more here, relate to the to that experience a little bit more here, or here. This is in London. The Battersea Power Station, which is still standing but no longer in use. It's an image. The next image you'll see was from Pink Floyd's The Wall, because this was the symbol that for them represented everything they were against. You have this real exaggeration. You get a sense of the sublime here, with the cloud configurations from the way that the light is hitting it, from where the shadows are. Smoke coming out of the stacks. Or here, this was the other major power plant in London along the Thames River. Bankside power station, which in the last decade has been converted into the Tate New Modern Art Museum. The only change externally was they added two stories to the top, which you can see here, that are all glass. But this is now, I mean, they were trying to recapture a sense of the sublime that was held by Londoners from 100 years previous, and filling it now with works of art. Okay, this one I love. Where is this?
Las Vegas,
outside of Las Vegas, Hoover Dam. This was completed in 1935. I think it took something like 4 years to build, which is an amazing achievement. This is a photo by Ansel Adams. Again, if a photographer of the status of Ansel Adams is going to photograph anything, it's got to, at least to him, convey a sense of the sublime. And he's going to milk it. He's going to find the sublime in it. Okay, here, aerial view. Now, this is built between 31 and 35, same time that the Empire State Building and the Chrysler Building in Manhattan are being built. And what I didn't see this before recently when I was looking at these images. This is an Art Deco dam. There is actually a design featured in this dam. Sense of the sublime. I mean, you get a sense here. They're releasing some of the water. The power that dam is holding back. Here is a man-made object that is holding back natural power. And controlling them, and converting them into power. Here we got two symbols juxtaposed. Another view of the dam. Here you can really see the Art Deco elements. And here's the heart of it, right here, down in the guts. There's 17 of these turbines. They generate together 5 billion kilowatt hours per year. So here it's not only the aesthetics or the idea of holding back natural powers, it's harnessing natural powers and generating usable power out of them. There are tours, and there were tours from the day that the dam opened into this turbine room of the dam. Tens of thousands of people every year visit this. Again, here's a postcard. Postcard makers are skilled at capturing the sublime elements of whatever it is they're photographing. There are these sculptures. There are actually 40 different brass sculptures made by the same sculptor, Oscar Hansen, who was commissioned. These are part of the memorial adjacent to the dam, memorializing the 97 men who lost their lives building the dam. Angels. It's hard to tell. I actually read an interview with the sculptor. For him, these are symbols of Americans.
Industrial angels.
Industrial angels, exactly. Pointing to the heavens, bringing down the power of the heavens. Kind of also eagle-like, sort of protecting this great symbol of American achievement, the Hoover Dam.
It looks rather Egyptian, too.
It does. Well, that's in keeping with an Art Deco kind of aesthetic.
We drove to the boat landing from southwestern Minnesota, and our three boys were more impressed with Grand Coulee Dam than the Rocky Mountains.
Is that right? And do you know why?
Maybe because they'd seen the Rocky Mountains before, but...
Well, I mean, they've been conditioned by the American technological sublime. They've absorbed it. They've inherited it. I mean, I'm going to get at this at the end of the week, but where we are now, I mean, we're still impressed with stuff like this, although there are great criticisms of dams, in particular this dam, but where our sense of the sublime today is with respect to technology is right here in computers. And the kind of the infinite mystery in miniature form, not in monumental form any longer. But we'll talk about that on Thursday.
Do you think this has any relationship to the Tower at Babel?
Oh, it has all kinds of relations. I mean, it's a biblical insight, right? It's us. Well, I don't want to be overly critical, but it is human beings taking the place of God, or at least believing that we can storm the heavens, that we can harness the powers of the heavens and bring them within our control. And there's a certain we are impressed with ourselves and our own achievements. Okay, skyscrapers, this is the last one, and then we'll call it an evening. This will be very quick. Skyscrapers, here is two important landmarks here. Who can identify them? Right, United Nations right here and here and there. And the Chrysler Building. Right, the Chrysler Building was the tallest building in the world for about 5 months. Until the Empire State Building, which is just a few blocks away, was completed. But it is, it's a beautiful building. And possibly you can see there the core, again, the Art Deco, kind of these tunnel towers that were coming out of Hoover Dam and the spire on the Chrysler Building. Okay, the Woolworth Building, finished in 1913, was the tallest building in the world. For about a decade, I believe. Maybe for 20 or 15 years. Until the early 30s when the Chrysler and the building and the Empire State Building were completed. Some of you in the room may be too young to remember Woolworth department stores, but probably half of us can remember them. This Mr. Woolworth built this, and he hired the architect to design it, and he told the architect, I'm going to lose a whole lot of money on this building, and I don't care. Because it's not the function of the building, it's the, in our 21st century terms, it's the marketing power of this symbol. I mean, he knew that if he built the tallest building in the world, he would get worldwide attention for Woolworths, which was originally a British company. And it worked. A beautiful building inside. I don't have any images of the inside, but inside it has what you would readily recognize as kind of cathedral, Gothic, sanctuary elements. Tile, domed ceilings. I mean, he even called it, Woolworth called it, a temple to commerce. And he knew what he was doing. And these early skyscrapers, until these early skyscrapers were built up, any city you went to, in Europe or in the United States, you're approaching it from a distance. What is the first building you're going to see because it's the tallest building in town?
The church.
The church, the steeple, the skyscrapers, these cathedrals to commerce, had the audacity to build towers that were taller than the tallest steeple in town. There were some cities that actually asserted building codes for quite a while to ensure that no skyscraper could be higher than the tallest church steeple in town. But the symbolism of this is significant. I mean, you just think about it. You know, if you look at the history of cities and what's important to us, either look at its monuments or its tallest buildings. And now, you know, of course, the tallest buildings in today's modern city are skyscrapers, but then ask yourself, what kind of business is transacted inside of that space? And that will tell you a lot about American values.
Washington, D.C. is an exception.
Is an exception, that's right. And then the national monuments have to take precedence. Yeah, yeah, there's still a building code there. There was a building code in Philadelphia for a long time. Uh-huh. Yeah. Then no building could be higher than William Penn on top of...
Billy Penn's hat on the
City
Hall.
City Hall.
Yep.
That's gone by the wayside, however.
Yeah, it has.
Okay. I promise you, we're almost done. Woolworth Building, another postcard. These aerial shots are wonderful at conveying a sense of the kind of the penetrating power of these man-made creations into the numinous, into the sublime, into the sacred. Now, here, this image is simply to see when it was built, how it dominated its neighborhood. Now look at this next image, which is contemporary. This is in the southern end of Manhattan, if you know how the city is laid out. Okay, so here's the what is it called, the garden?
Oh, yeah.
That was built in the foreground there. It's this big glass, what do they call those?
Atrium,
right. Where there are trees inside and symphonies play during the lunch hour, and there's the Woolworth Tower in the background. The World Trade Center was just behind this building on the right. So it's been dwarfed. And here it is on the day of 9/11. And in the days after. Okay, we're going to end here. But I hope from today what you've got is an idea of what I'm talking about. I'm going to be talking about this week. Crucial terms, manna, this undifferentiated power, the sublime, which we can have an experience of. It's this rise of passions within us. Simultaneously, we are attracted and repelled. The mysterious and the terrifying, that's the sublime, or it's the experience of the holy. That there are many things that are not overtly religious that we could have these experiences in the presence of, and that tells us a lot about what kind of the sacred ecology of our own spirituality or our own mindset as individuals and as a culture. It gives us some pretty significant clues. Whatever you find yourself in the presence of when you're having these feelings rise within you, I'm telling you, you're in the presence of something that you value extremely highly and that conveys to you that it is awfully close to what you consider the divine. Okay, tomorrow we'll pick this up. We'll be looking at advertising looking at a lot of commercials and sort of how advertisers tap into certain religious longings, yearnings, inclinations, and fears in order to get us to buy their products. Okay, that's tomorrow. Thank you.